Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we welcome into the studio Baratunde Thurston and Tanner Colby, one black guy, one white guy, to not be subtle about it, to talk about race 2013 and the state of interracial friendships in America. Baratunde, as you may know, is the comedian and author of the book How to Be Black. Tanner is the author of the book Some of My Best Friends Are Black. They are hosting an event Thursday evening in New York City together and are here to preview it. Let's call it a conversation about a conversation about our conversations about race. In other words, it's a conversation about race. Baratunde, Tanner, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. It's an interracial conversation about race.
Yeah, thank you very much for having
so
us
your,
on.
So your event on Thursday, so everybody knows, is being moderated by Soledad O'Brien, well-known for her work with CNN.
Yep.
And it looks like it's going to be pretty wide-ranging, but I thought for our conversation we would focus on interracial friendships because both of you have written and talked about them a fair amount. And I'm not sure how close friends you two are.
I hate this, man.
Yeah, it's purely a professional arrangement.
That's what I thought. And how did you decide to pair up for this, other than the fact that your book titles, How to Be Black and Some of My Best Friends Are Black, make perfect sense together? Or maybe that's enough of a reason right there.
Well, I first heard about Baratunde. We have a friend in common, my upstairs neighbor, Jill Filipovich, who is also my dog sitter, is really sort of how we met. I was at Jill's holiday party, and she said, oh, you're writing a book called Some of My Best Friends Are Black. Another friend of mine, one of my black friends, is writing a book called How to Be Black. And so I sent him my book, and because we were looking for blurbs and endorsements, and he blurbed the book, and we sort of got to know each other through that. And we've been talking for a year about doing something, and we finally just got around to it.
We were brought together by a feminist writing white woman who thought we would get along well together.
Right.
And actually, I read his book, and I was, first of all, I'm like, his name's Tanner Colby. That's a pretty white-sounding name, and he's writing his book called Some of My Best Friends Are Black. Let me check this out. And then I actually liked it, and I felt like I learned things. And I get excited when non-people of color start to take on some of these issues dealing with race, just like men taking on issues of feminism. And so when Tanner did the work he did in the book, I was a fan of it, and we started communicating post-book reading after that.
Like what? Tell everybody one thing from the book that landed with you.
Well, so Tanner's book, from my perspective, he explores, and you can correct me if I'm totally wrong here, why integration has failed. In the United States, we had a lot of plans and dreams and legislation, but on the ground, it hasn't led to a lot of direct interaction in the workplace, in churches, in our living, and in our schools. And what I learned most about was that there was a conscious effort to prevent that. When you look at the development of private communities and suburbs and whole new school districts, a lot of that was backlash. And when we talk about the history of civil rights and all the progress we've made, we don't often pay a lot of attention to the downside of all that and the negative reaction that was so steeped, not just culturally, but in government processes and in bank loans and everything else. So the fight against civil rights is one of the big things that I think his book does a better job of unearthing than our basic understanding.
And tying the personal and the cultural to the legal, I think, is very related to what Eric Holder, the attorney general, said in 2009, tying again, civil rights in the United States to the state of interracial friendships. And I want to play this clip.
As a nation, we've done a pretty good job in melding the races in the workplace. We work with one another, we lunch together, and when the event is at the workplace during work hours, such as this, or shortly thereafter, we socialize with one another fairly well, irrespective of race. And yet, even this interaction operates within certain limitations. And outside the workplace, the situation is even more bleak, in that there is almost no significant interaction between us.
Tanner, how do you react to that?
I think it's absolutely true. What happened after the backlash to civil rights was that a significant portion of the white community just said, we want nothing to do with this and we're fleeing to the suburbs. And then you also had a portion of the white community that's like, well, we want to engage with black America, like this neighborhood in Kansas City that I profiled. They wanted to create an integrated neighborhood, and they went about it in a very conscientious way of trying to engage. And even there, it barely worked because of this cultural gap that existed between blacks and whites. And on the black side of the aisle, you had a large portion of the civil rights movement that wasn't really about integration, but was more about black power and ethnic solidarity. And then you had a lot of the black community that did cross the color line in the workplace and other places. And they were treated so horribly that they were like, okay, you know what? We're out of here. We took care of ourselves for 400 years and we'll do it again. And so playing off this sort of cultural antipathy, what the Nixon administration and a lot of people in power did, or, you know, tried to do, was they said, well, the easiest way to keep the color line in place is to make it porous. And to allow it a certain give and take. And if we do that, then people will more or less stay where they are.
So, listeners, we're going to open up the phones, and we want you to help drive this conversation about interracial friendships. The phones are open, 212-433-WNYC. How difficult are interracial friendships in your experience? 212-433-9692. How important are interracial friendships to racial progress, as per Eric Holder and both of our guests? 212-433-WNYC. If you find interracial friendships difficult, what do people do wrong? Is this about sort of too many questions about your hair, or, you know, what gets in the way here? 212-433-9692, the state of your interracial friendships, good, bad, or mixed, and how important do you think this is to racial progress and the sense of equality? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. For Baratunde Thurston and Colby Tanner, one the author of How to Be Black, the other the author of Some of My Best Friends Are Black, and looking at our phone board, wow. Either everybody in our listening audience has interracial friendships, or everybody is so discouraged about not having interracial friendships that everybody called up all at once. I do want to throw in one piece of breaking news that just crossed the AP wire, because we've been talking so much about the congressional decision on Syria today. We have just learned that the House Speaker John Boehner has announced his support for President Obama's call for action against Syria, and says his colleague should also. So Boehner putting it on the line on the Syria intervention. Either this is going to bring along enough Tea Party members, or this is going to be the moment at which they finally kick him off the island.
And the relationship between John Boehner and Barack Obama being a perfect example of the interracial relationships we talk about.
Where do you think race comes in?
Did he say good friend Barack Obama when he announced that?
But is there something there about race? You know, people don't really seem to comment much about race and the tugs of war that the speaker and the president have over the deficit and things like that. Do you think it's an under-discussed element, Tanner? Is that what you're saying?
No, I mean, I was just sort of making an observation. But, you know, what Boehner's personal feelings are about Obama and Obama in the reverse of that, I don't really know. Baratunde, your thoughts?
I have no thoughts on the likely shallow friendship.
Yeah, I imagine
the president and the speaker of the House.
There's probably a lot of other things getting in the way there besides race.
Yeah, like power. Mostly it's power.
Mm-hmm.
I loved when Mayor Dinkins was known to New Yorkers as such a big tennis fan. Which is not, I mean, other than Arthur Ashe, it's just sort of not what you think of as the thing that the guy from Harlem is going to be passionate about. And Giuliani couldn't stand it.
Really? I wasn't in New York at that time, so I missed the what was Giuliani's issue with?
Used it against him in so many ways, because then he was both a black person and uppity elite.
Right.
Right.
Also, there was a signal right there.
Right.
Not one of us. Not one of you. Yeah. Way to go, Giuliani.
But Tanner, in your book, you talk about getting caught up in the 2008 Obama race and this idea that Obama became a lot of young white voters' new black friend.
Pretty much. Pretty much. It was easier to vote for a black man than to sit and have a beer with one. Because I went around, I was sort of watching everything take place with the election. And a lot of my friends work in media here in New York, which is very lily white. New York Times, The Economist, all these institutions. And we'd get together for primary night and watch all the returns come in. And it was always white people all the time. And so, I sort of realized that black people and white people were supporting Obama, but for different reasons and from different zip codes. And so, I wanted to find out really look at the failure of integration from the point of view of all these middle class white people who didn't know any black people.
You reminded me of a story in my book, which is W. Kamau Bell, who now has a show on FX called Totally Biased. He describes his election night experience in San Francisco, and he's walking down the street and he sees a really excited group of white people. You know, they're, yay, Barack Obama. And then he turns the corner and they see him, and their yay goes to silence because it's like, oh, we like that black man, but not this actual black man right here. And there was such a massive gap between the president and this average black dude walking down the street.
Let's start getting some. Go ahead.
No, my interesting Obama campaign experience is I went and did door-to-door work for Obama in Philadelphia because you had to go to a purple state to actually make a difference. And one thing that they wanted to tell all the voters as we went door-to-door was that the Republicans were spreading, you know, dirty tricks about how if you had an outstanding conviction or an outstanding child support, if you go to the polls, you're going to get arrested.
Right.
And they wanted to inform all – it was in a low-income black area where we were canvassing. They wanted to inform all these low-income black people, you know, don't fall for the Republican dirty tricks. What was me and a very upper-middle-class black guy doing the canvassing – and now you imagine a white guy going in to all of these low-income black houses saying, now, if you haven't paid your child support, if you're a convict, don't worry about it. You can vote. They just, you know, did not go well. So I just kind of stopped saying that. And it came off worse from the black guy than it did from me.
Really?
Because when he started saying, now, if you haven't paid your child support or if you're a convict, don't worry about it, it was just really, really bad.
Mm. Listeners, my guests are Tanner Colby, author of Some of My Best Friends Are Black, and Baratunde Thurston, author of How to Be Black. And the reason that they are here together, if you're just tuning in, is that they will be in conversation this Thursday, moderated by Soledad O'Brien at Subculture Event Space in Soho. That starts at 7 p.m. on Thursday, so you football fans can just, you know, DVR the NFL season kickoff game and watch it later. More information about their event on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Let's go to the phones. Narda in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling in.
I love your show.
Thank you.
Which every now and then I'm told it's not very black of you, but I digress. I was telling the person who screened the call that I've always been raised and taught that people are people, no matter what color. And so I have my friends and I, we're like a rainbow coalition, and we just don't see color. I mean, we're aware that their racism exists, and in fact, sometimes my Jewish friends get more fired up than I do about some of the atrocities that continue to happen in this modern world. But I'm very hopeful. I mean, I have an Asian husband and we have an interracial daughter, and I'm very hopeful for the future for her and for the other children that we see growing up in our neighborhood, which is very diverse, and just very hopeful that people will continue to make this world a better place.
Narda, this is Baratunde. Thank you so much for weighing in on this. I wanted to know, how did you and your friends find each other initially, and what setting did you meet?
Through school. I went to private schools. I was fortunate enough that my parents sacrificed and they invested in their five children and wanted to put us all in private school. So we were often only one of two black children in a predominantly white school. And because I came out of the womb, my mom says, just being very friendly and just curious about everybody, I never really saw any difference. Yes, hair textures were different. Mm-hmm. Socioeconomic may have been a little bit different, but the fact that I was there in these schools with these friends, I always believed that I belonged there, and no one could make me feel less than who I was.
Narda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Cal in Millburn. You're on WNYC. Hello, Cal.
Hi. I just want to point out the importance of that sports can play in encouraging interracial friendships. I grew up in Newark in the 1950s in an all-white neighborhood. But when I went to high school, our high school, Southside, was half white, half black, and I joined the baseball team. And once I got on the team, we just developed these wonderful friendships with the African American players, and the same happened, I think, with the football. Even the kids went to the chess club, but any kind of thing in the classroom itself, people sort of stayed apart. But when you join a club or a team, you really developed a friendship, and these people were just not masks. There were people, and we developed friendships that lasted over the years.
I think it's a really great question, and I wonder if you both have, Tanner and Baratunde, thoughts about the role of sports in, you know, personalizing the other. Right. When people, especially around the same teams.
Well, I think it's not just sports. I mean, sports is probably the biggest and has played the largest and most forward-leaning role in that way. But, you know, it's any activity. People bond over what they have in common. Black people and white people aren't just going to, like, be friends because we're supposed to fix a historical mistake. We're going to be friends because we want to be and we have something to focus on. Like, in my high school in Birmingham, Alabama, which was one of these white flight high schools formed exclusively to try and keep black people out, and our official school flag was a Confederate flag. So, you know, they had black students bussed in, but they were not part of the community. They didn't participate in any events. They barely participated in athletics. And, in fact, I was going back through the yearbook when I was writing the book, and there was only one black student in the Multicultural Awareness Club. So that tells you pretty much. But then
that's awesome.
When I went
back,
part of the problem is they were bussed in and they were bussed back out at 3:30, so they weren't a part of the community. But as I went back now, there's far more black people living in the community. The students are they're integrated into the activities. If you open up the yearbook, you know, it's a rainbow by rainbow coalition, I still mean 85% white, but, you know, everyone is participating.
Relatively,
everyone's participating in the events and in the activities. And so that was really one of the problems with integration, was because we had to sort of force it. The only brute force metric you had was how many black people are enrolled. Your school is 20% black. But if the school is 20% black and all the black kids are just going home at 3:30, that's not really integration.
There aren't that many activities that I could think of, Baratunde, or venues. You know, I think of of sports and the military, where they're these sort of relatively pure meritocracies, and they draw people in a less biased way than other. Of course, there's definitely an economic draft, which in the military puts more people of color in proportional to their presence in the population. But then once they're in, there are a lot of mechanisms of integration. Now, I imagine it's a coincidence that it's these two relatively macho institutions, the military and sports. I don't know if there are any female-oriented ones that can come to mind, but too bad we don't have more.
What might explain those, and this is armchair sociology going on as a disclaimer, but both of those have a level of forced teamwork and trust and reliability. Like, you've got to give, like, team sports especially. I did track and field for most of my school era, and that was heavily black and brown, even within a school that wasn't. But then when I started wrestling, that shifted my own, you know, the group of people I spent lots of hours with. You're sweating on top of each other. That's pretty intimate. Mm-hmm. And you literally get to know each other really well. And the military, obviously, it's a life or death situation. You have to trust your fellow service members. I had another team type-like experience in college, which was through the newspaper. And again, it took a lot of sacrifice. You know, it's not a sport, but it was a team effort. And one adjustment that the newspaper made, there's an effort sometimes when you talk about the idea of integration, where you just, if you remove a barrier, you expect magic to happen. You're like, look, I listed the job. Nobody bothered to show up. Oh, well. And the newspaper was kind of like that. When you mentioned economic draft, you reminded me of this. If you had enough money on top of your tuition to be able to afford to give 20 extra hours a week to do this voluntary newspaper service, you were in. But a lot of students on financial aid couldn't do that. So the newspaper ultimately created its own financial aid program because they saw the lack, and the numbers changed dramatically because the doors were truly not just barred but open.
Now, Tanner, you mentioned that you grew up in the white flight suburbs of the Deep South. Baratunde, you grew up in Washington, D.C., which is technically in the South, but certainly has more of a northern sensibility.
Some special zone.
That's right. And went to a mostly white high school. There's the cliche that in the South, blacks and whites interact much more, but there's more entrenched racism. And in the North, everyone says all the right things about race, but hardly any white people actually have any black friends. Do you find that to be true, Tanner?
I think generally so. I mean, the way I've heard it phrased is in the South, Black people can get as close as they want as long as they don't get too high. In the North, black people can get as high as they want as long as they don't get too close. Like in the North, you can go to Harlem to be a millionaire and you know, have a black-owned business and be a part of that empire or part of that neighborhood, but you know, you're not going to have too much interaction with white people. Whereas in the South, we're all close. Oh, we're all, you know, great friends, and you know, but it's really a very paternalistic, oh, you know, our butler, he's like family kind of thing. And so, you know, though, and I think those dynamics are kind of true, but also not. It's far more complicated than that. And when I went back and looked, the most progress that I've in all the areas where I looked at race were in the South. We're looking at the small town church in Louisiana where they've integrated black and white Catholic parishes from different sides of town. And in my old neighborhood in Birmingham, Alabama, there has been more progress, you know, hard fought and difficult progress in those two places than in, say, the advertising industry in New York where I worked.
You agree?
I agree with the general tones. I think what also shifts in the northern side of things, which is where my living experience has been, my neighborhood looks very different. You know, Mount Pleasant in Washington, D.C., from where I grew up. But it's not because the attitudes of the people changed. It's that the people wholesale changed. Like, gentrification has remapped a lot of these neighborhoods. And you've got a different, very different quantity and type of white person living in that neighborhood and a different type of black and brown person living in that neighborhood than in the 1980s when I grew up.
We'll continue in a minute with more of your calls for Baratunde Thurston, author of How to Be Black, and Tanner Colby, author of Some of My Best Friends Are Black. Tell us your stories of interracial friendships. How difficult are they? How satisfying? How important do you think they are to racial progress toward equality in America? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And since our lines are full, you can also post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. More in a minute. Brian Lehr on WNYC as we continue with Baratunde Thurston, author of How to Be Black, and Tanner Colby, author of Some of My Best Friends Are Black, a preview of what might be in their conversation on Thursday night in an event moderated by Soledad O'Brien at Subculture Event Space in Soho, 7 o'clock Thursday night. And Tanner, people, if they don't go in person, they can stream this?
This will be available via live stream over the interweb. They can get more information at togather.com/aboutrace. Together is the service that's helping us put this together. They crowdsource events by letting fans and readers put together their own events with authors and celebrities. And people will be able to buy bundled autographed copies of both books for $25, and all of the proceeds from that will go to Soledad O'Brien's charitable foundation, which helps young women go to college.
And just for folks to understand the significance of this conversation, the full name of the event is actually very important. It is our national conversation about conversations about race, an evening of interracial conversation with Baratunde Thurston and Tanner Colby, moderated by America's leading multiracial conversationalist, Soledad O'Brien. If you say that full thing, you get a special black card when you show up.
But then the show is over.
Right. It Burning takes the time. Entire length Burning of the time. Show yes. to say the title.
And we have more information, folks, and you know about how to get there or how to stream it on our page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show if you want to learn more. So on interracial friendships, Elisa in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Brooklyn. Hello, Elisa.
Hi.
Hey
Thanks
there.
For taking my call. My thoughts, I have white friends. I'm black. And my white friends, I feel, live in fantasy land. They're always speaking themselves up as if, you know, like, oh, I was in Amagansett for the weekend or something like that. And in essence, they are really poor. They don't grasp the reality that what it is. And I guess it's maybe that they don't want to be poor or it would create a different class for them. But it's a real issue that I always have with some of my white friends. They always pumping themselves up to be something more, and they're not.
What's an example of that? Can you put any story
yeah,
in
let's
there?
Say, I have a girlfriend who's supposed to be in going into the art world. She hasn't been working for over 2 years. And so she says, oh, I'm doing this in the arts. I've touched base with this person in the arts. Oh, I created a website. And in essence, it's been 2 years. She's been saying the same thing in public when we go out to people. And nothing has ever materialized.
So you need
ever.
To choose less for flaky friends, Elisa. Yeah. That's really
well,
what
it could be flaky friends, but I find it happens in other, when I'm
right.
speaking to other whites sometimes,
so
you know, they're always pumping themselves up.
There's a pattern there. As
uppity white folks.
There's the authority on this one.
Yeah, I don't know if that's there's certainly a certain subset of white people that are like that. I think there's probably subsets of all ethnicities that are a little bit.
It sounds very American to
yeah,
me, actually.
No, that's probably a more American characteristic.
Like just marketing over substance. We're very good at selling ourselves and not always following through.
Tom in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Hey there, guys. I just wanted to chime in. I'm a 30-year-old straight white guy in Brooklyn who enjoys a fairly diverse set of friends. And when discussing the differences in the way that we see things, we find that sexual orientation, economic position, and religion are such more significant controlling factors, more over race in the way that we relate to each other. Now, of course, when you go macro, socioeconomic, and race can definitely attach themselves, but in the microcosm of the people I know, those other issues they stimulate such deeper conversations than what color we are.
Can I ask Tanner a question related to this? So in terms of failure of integration, did you come across any stories of cross-class, you know, relationships and friendships versus cross-race relationships?
Very few. In fact, after 4 years of doing this book, I've made lots of black friends. I still have virtually no friends who don't have a four-year college degree.
Right.
You know, that barrier is much bigger. It's all a big stew. Religion plays into it, class, political affiliation, race, everything. It all mixes together. But it basically comes down to people are always going to be tribal. You're always going to find tribalism around church or religion or socioeconomic class or all of these things. So it's more a question of redefining your tribe. Like Baratunde and I, we've both been to college. We live in similar neighborhoods. Baratunde and I are going to find more in common around our sort of class and cultural issues than I have in common with a lot of the white people that I grew up with in Alabama. I'm no longer part of that tribe. I'm now part of like a multiracial tribe that defines itself not by race but by other factors.
By coffee.
By coffee. We define ourselves by latte. So it's just a question of picking the tribe that you want to join. And
Tanner, your book is called Some of My Best Friends Are Black. It's not called Some of My Best Friends Are Non-White. So even as the demographic shift in America is being driven by Latinos and Asians, is there still something particular about the black-white divide?
Oh, absolutely. And there was a study that came out a couple weeks ago by Reuters that asked like white people, how many non-white friends do you have, which is kind of a meaningless question. Because I've had Hispanic, Middle Eastern, and Asian friends my whole life. It really didn't merit writing a book. And, you know, if you look at the immigration patterns of those groups, it really only started in the last 40 years, since the late 1960s. And so first-generation Hispanics aren't going to be friends with middle-class white people. So that's really more of a generational shift of those demographics integrating into America. And those groups are integrating rather rapidly. I believe Asians intermarry at a rate of like 30%. Whereas the divide between black America and white America is much deeper. It has big socioeconomic factors, big discrimination factors, and also just these cultural factors we've talked about of white people not wanting to engage with black people and black people not wanting to engage with white people.
Stephanie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just think it's so important to have interracial friendships. I'm a 31-year-old straight white woman, and I have a lot of black friends from sort of all different spectrums, and some of them, race isn't a thing. It doesn't come up. We don't talk about it. And some of them, it is a thing. Like, it's talked about frequently, and there are uncomfortable moments, and there are times where we're learning a lot about each other and about, the struggles of the black community. You know, if we talk about stop and frisk, we talk about, like, police brutality. You know, it's definitely racially targeted, and that's a huge difference. And I just think, and then I also have a lot of white friends, some of whom really don't have black friends and they see this huge, like, cultural divide. There's just this total, like, gap in understanding that, you know, I think if people just related and could speak about these things, you know, make a huge difference. And I think like, it's you know, white people's job to talk to other white people about this.
Right.
That's a fabulous point.
But that's harder than you think. I actually know, as someone who, you know, was fairly ignorant about race 5 years ago, who's gone through this process of researching and learning about everything, I can't really talk to my white friends about what I have done with work.
But you must.
But it's so boring. It's so boring. There's been a phenomenon over the past 5 years of I've been working on this book, and I meet a white person at a party, and I tell them about this book I've written. And then in the next 3 minutes, they tell me their black person story. Which is, oh my God, that's so interesting. You're writing this book. Like, there was a black girl at my high school. I mean, she was biracial, but, you know, one time she did X. Mm. Insert anecdote here. And then about four or five minutes later, the conversation just peters out. So they have nothing left to say.
Does everyone need to write a book? Is that the path?
You know, I say that if we want to have reparations for slavery and segregation in this country, don't give any money to black people. Just take all that money and send white people off to, like, get a black studies degree. And then we can start this process. Because, you know, people say, oh, we have to have a conversation about race. White people don't have the vocabulary to participate in the conversation on any real meaningful level.
It's really true. I think it's true. I think it's one of the most important things that white people can do is consciously think about and talk about race. All the books about race are by black people, almost all.
Right.
And it's like feminism, you know?
Right.
Women changed, and men are still dealing with women changing, but they're not changing.
But one of the
They are, but, you know, it's similar. And we have to leave it there, sorry to say, because the clock is no longer our friend. It was our friend for a while.
Thursday night.
Tune in Thursday night for the rest of the conversation.
Baratunde Thurston is a comedian and founder of Cultivated Wit. His book is called How to Be Black. Tanner Colby is a journalist and author whose latest book is Some of My Best Friends Are Black. They are in conversation this Thursday, moderated by Soledad O'Brien at Subculture Event Space in Soho. It starts at 7 p.m. So, as I said before, you can TiVo or DVR the NFL season kickoff game and watch it later if that's your thing. You can also stream their event live. More information on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. What was that last thought you want to make? We have a few seconds.
Where were we?
I would say here's a last thought. You know, knowledge can be transferred through books, through black studies degrees, but to the point of this show, the actual relationships of friends is among the least efficient but deepest forms of knowledge and empathy transfer we could have. So keep doing that, people.
Yeah.
Great conversation. Baratunde Tanner, thanks a lot. Brian Lehrer.
Thank you.
On WNYC.